The Grotesques. Another set of drawings that Leonardo produced for the amusement of the Sforza court were pen and ink caricatures of funny-looking people he dubbed visi mostruosi, monstrous faces, which are now commonly called his grotesques. Most are small, just under the size of a credit card. Satirical in intent, they were, like his allegorical drawings, probably accompaniments to spoken tales, jokes, or performances at the castle. At least 2 dozen originals survive, and there are many close copies produced by the students in his studio. See figures 26 and 27. The grotesques were reproduced or mimicked by later artists, most notably the 17th-century Bohemian etcher Wenceslaus Hollar and the 19th-century British illustrator John Tenniel, who used them as models for the Ugly Duchess and other characters in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. With his finely honed ability to see both beauty and ugliness, Leonardo was able to create a satirical combination in his grotesques. As he wrote in his notes for his treatise on painting, "If the painter wishes to see beauties that charm him, it lies within his power to create them. And if he wishes to see monstrosities that are frightful, buffoonish, or ridiculous, or pitiable, he can be lord thereof." The grotesques are examples of how Leonardo's observational skills became fodder for his imagination. He would walk the streets with a notebook dangling from his belt, find a group of people with exaggerated features who would make good models, and invite them over for supper. Sitting close to them, his early biographer Lomazzo recounted, Leonardo then proceeded to tell the maddest and most ridiculous tales imaginable, making them laugh uproariously. He observed all their gestures very attentively and those ridiculous things they were doing, and impressed them on his mind. And after they had left, he retired to his room and there made a perfect drawing. Lomazzo indicated that part of the purpose was to amuse his patrons at the Sforza court. The drawings moved those who looked at them to laughter, as if they had been moved by Leonardo's stories at the feast. In notes for his treatise on painting, Leonardo recommended to young artists this practice of walking around town, finding people to use as models, and recording the most interesting ones in a portable notebook. "Take a note of them with slight strokes in a little book, which you should always carry with you," he wrote. "The positions of the people are so infinite that the memory is incapable of retaining them, which is why you should keep these sketches as your guides." Sometimes Leonardo used a pen on such face-hunting excursions, and when that was not practical in an outdoor setting, he used a stylus. The sharp silver point of the stylus made lines on paper that had been coated with ground chicken bones, soot, or other chalky powders, sometimes coloured with pulverized minerals. The metal point oxidized this coating, producing silvery-grey lines. He also occasionally used chalk, charcoal, or lead. As was his nature, he was constantly experimenting with drawing methods. These face-finding excursions, along with the sketches that resulted, helped Leonardo in his quest to find ways to relate facial features to inner emotions. At least since the time of Aristotle, who declared, "It is possible to infer character from features," people had tried to find ways to assess people's innate personality from their head shapes and facial characteristics, a study known as physiognomy. With his empirical mind, Leonardo rejected the scientific validity of this method and dismissed it as akin to astrology and alchemy. "I will not dwell on false physiognomy and palm reading because there is no truth in them, and illusions of this kind have no scientific foundation," he insisted. But even though he did not consider physiognomy a science, he did believe that facial expressions indicate underlying causes. "Characteristics of the face partly reveal the character of men, their vices and temperaments," he wrote. "If the features which separate the cheeks from the lips or the nostrils from the cavities of the eyes are strongly pronounced, they belong to cheerful and good-humoured men." "Those without such distinctive lines are more contemplative," he added, "and those whose facial features stand out in great relief are brutal, bad-tempered, and men of little reason." He went on to associate heavy lines between the eyebrows with bad temper, strong lines on the forehead with regrets, and concluded, "It is possible to discuss many features this way." He developed a trick for noting these features of a face so that he could draw them later. It involved a shorthand for 10 types of nose, straight, bulbous, hollow, 11 types of facial shape, and various other characteristics that could be categorized. When he found a person he wished to draw, he would use this shorthand so that he could recreate him or her when he got back to his studio. With the grotesque faces, however, that was not necessary because they were so memorable. "Of grotesque faces I need say nothing, because they are kept in mind without difficulty," he declared. The most memorable of Leonardo's grotesque drawings is one of five heads that he did around 1494, see figure 28. The central figure is an old man with the aquiline nose and jutting jaw that Leonardo favoured for his typical aging warrior character. He is wearing a wreath of oak leaves and trying to maintain a dignified pose while in fact looking a bit gullible and foolish. The four characters surrounding him are laughing maniacally or smirking. Leonardo likely drew the scene as part of a facetious tale that he recounted for the amusement of the Sforza court, but no notes survive. That is fortunate because it allows us to apply our own imagination to the drawing and to Leonardo. Perhaps the man is about to marry the pug-faced crone depicted in one of Leonardo's other drawings from the same time, and his friends are showing a mix of derision and compassion. Maybe the drawing is an exaggerated illustration of human traits, such as lunacy and dementia and megalomania. A more plausible explanation, since this was probably for a performance at court, is that there was a narrative story involved. The man on the right seems to be holding the hand of the wreath's central character, while the man on the left is reaching around his back towards his pocket. Could it be a scene of a man having his palm read and being pickpocketed by gypsies, as Windsor's curator Martin Clayton suggests? Gypsies from the Balkans had spread throughout Europe in the 15th century and become such a nuisance in Milan that they were banished by a decree in 1493. In his notebooks, Leonardo mentioned a portrayal of a gypsy in a list of his drawings, and he also recorded spending 6 soldi for a fortune teller. All of this is speculative, and that is one of the many things that make Leonardo's works, including those with a bit of mystery, so wonderful. His fantasia is infectious. Literary amusements. Another contribution that Leonardo made to life at the Sforza court were little literary amusements which were also primarily intended to be read aloud or performed. There are at least 300 of them in his notebooks, in a variety of forms, fables, facetious tales, prophecies, pranks, and riddles. These are scattered in the margins of pages or next to unrelated items, so we know they were not intended to be collections on their own. Instead, they were produced to provide entertainment whenever the occasion warranted. Oral performances and declamations of riddles and fables were a popular form of amusement at Renaissance courts. Leonardo even included stage directions on some. Next to one cryptic prophecy, he directed that it should be delivered in a frenzied or berserk way, as of mental lunacy. He was a clever conversationalist and storyteller, according to Vasari, and that served him well with these slight entertainments that might seem, in retrospect, trivial endeavours. He had not yet been established as one of history's great geniuses, so he was hustling to curry favour at a crowded ducal court. The fables are pithy moral tales involving animals or objects that take on a personality. They have common themes, most notably the rewards due to virtue and prudence versus the penalties engendered by greed and haste. Although they bear some similarity to Aesop's fables, they are shorter. Most are not particularly clever or even easily comprehensible, at least out of the context of whatever was happening at court that evening. For example, the mole has very small eyes, and it always lives underground. It lives as long as it is in the dark, but when it comes into the light, it dies immediately, because it becomes known. And so it is with lies. More than 50 of these fables were jotted in his notebooks during the 17 years he spent in Milan. Closely related are the entries in his bestiary, a compendium of short tales of animals and moral lessons based on their traits. Bestiaries were popular among the ancients and in the Middle Ages, and the spread of printing presses meant that many were reprinted in Italy beginning in the 1470s. Leonardo had a copy of the bestiary written by Pliny the Elder and three others by medieval compilers. In contrast to the entries in these collections, Leonardo's tended to be pithy and unadorned with religious trappings. They were probably connected to emblems, heraldic shields, and performances that he created for those in the Sforza circle. The swan is white without any spot, and it sings sweetly as it dies, its life ending with that song, one of them states. Occasionally, Leonardo appended a moral lesson to the entry, such as this: "The oyster, when the moon is full, opens itself wide, and when the crab looks in, he throws in a stone or seaweed, and the oyster cannot close again, whereby it serves for food to that crab. This is what happens to him who opens his mouth to tell his secret. He becomes the prey of the treacherous hearer." A third type of literary amusement was one that Leonardo pioneered in the 1490s. He called them prophecies, and they were often little riddles or trick questions. He was particularly fond of describing some scene of darkness and destruction in a style that mocked the prophets and doomsayers who hung around the court, then revealing that he was actually referring to something far less apocalyptic. For example, one prophecy begins, "Many people, by puffing out of breath with too much haste, will thereby lose their sight, and soon after, all consciousness." But then Leonardo reveals that the description refers to people blowing out the candlelight when going to bed. Many of the prophecy riddles reflect Leonardo's love for animals. "Countless numbers will have their little children taken away, and their throats shall be cut," is one prophecy, as if describing a brutal act of war and genocide. But then Leonardo, who had become a vegetarian, reveals that this prophecy refers to the sheep and cows that humans eat. "Winged creatures will support people with their feathers," he wrote in another example, and then revealed that he was not referring to flying machines, but the feathers used to stuff mattresses. As they say in show business, you had to be there. Leonardo accompanied these literary amusements with pranks and tricks on occasion, such as flash explosions. "Boil 10 pounds of brandy to evaporate, but see that the room is completely closed and throw up some powdered varnish among the fumes," he wrote in his notebook. "Then enter the room suddenly with a lighted torch, and at once it will be set ablaze." Vasari described how Leonardo took a lizard captured by an assistant, pasted on a beard and wings, and kept it in a box to frighten his friends. He also took the intestines of a steer and made them so fine that they could be compressed into the palm of one hand. Then he would fix one end of them to a pair of bellows lying in another room, and when they were inflated, they filled the room in which they were and forced anyone standing there into a corner. Puns were popular then, and Leonardo often created visual versions of them, such as when he painted a juniper in the portrait of Ginevra de' Benci. One way he played with puns was by creating for the court cryptograms, pictographs, and rebuses, in which pictures were lined up to create a message that had to be decoded while Leonardo watched. For example, he drew an ear of corn for grain, grano in Italian, and a magnetic rock, calamità, to make a punning version of the phrase great calamity, gran calamità. Using both sides of a large notebook sheet, he drew more than 150 of these little puzzles, sketching them quickly, as if he were creating them in front of an audience. Leonardo's notebooks also contained drafts of fantasy novellas, sometimes in the form of letters describing mysterious lands and adventures. More than a century earlier, the Florentine writer and humanist Giovanni Boccaccio had popularized tales, most notably the Decameron, that skated between fantasia and realism. Leonardo did likewise in at least two sustained drafts of long stories. One of these was probably performed at a farewell party in 1487 for Benedetto Dei, a fellow Florentine who was part of the Sforza court in Milan. It was cast as a letter to Dei, who travelled extensively and spun wondrous and occasionally embellished tales. The villain is a black giant, with bloodshot eyes and a face most horrible, who terrorizes the inhabitants of North Africa. He lived in the sea and fed on whales, leviathans, and ships, Leonardo wrote. The men of the area swarm all over the giant like ants, but to no avail. He shook his head and sent the men flying through the air like hail. The tale is an early example of a theme that Leonardo would return to repeatedly until the end of his life. Cataclysmic scenes of destruction and deluge that consume all earthly life. Leonardo's narrator is swallowed by the giant and finds himself swimming in a dark void. The story ends with a lament that describes those nightmarish demons unleashed from the shadowy cave that plagued and drove and stymied Leonardo throughout his life. I do not know what to say or what to do, for everywhere I seem to find myself swimming head downwards through that mighty throat and remaining buried in that huge belly in the confusion of death. This dark side of Leonardo's genius is also evident in the other fantasy novella he sketched out while working at the Milan court, which foreshadows the deluge drawings and descriptions he did near the end of his life. This one is composed as a series of letters written by a prophet and water engineer, who is clearly Leonardo himself, to the Devadar of Syria, lieutenant of the sacred Sultan of Babylon. Once again, the narrative involves deluge and destruction. First we were assailed by the fury of the winds, and then followed the avalanches from the great mountains of snow which filled up all these valleys and destroyed a great part of our city. And, not content with this, the tempest with a sudden deluge of water has submerged all the lower part of this city. Added to this, there came a sudden rain, or rather a ruinous storm full of water, sand, mud, and stones, all mingled together with roots, stems, and branches of trees. And every kind of thing came hurtling through the air and descended upon us. Finally, there came a great fire, not brought by the wind, but carried, it would seem, by 30,000 devils, completely burnt up and destroyed the country. The tale shows his fantasies about being a hydraulic engineer. The Syrian storm, Leonardo's narrator recounts, is tamed by building a huge drainage tunnel through the Taurus Mountains. Some Leonardo scholars have interpreted these writings as a sign that he was suffering bouts of madness. Others have concluded that he actually went to Armenia and had the experience of the deluge he described. I think a more reasonable explanation is that these tales, like many of the odd things Leonardo wrote, were intended for performance at court. But even if merely designed to amuse his patrons, they hint at something deeper, providing a glimpse into the psychological torments swirling in the psyche of the artist playing the entertainer. Chapter 7. Personal Life. Outstanding Beauty and Infinite Grace. Leonardo became known in Milan not only for his talents, but also for his good looks, muscular build, and gentle personal style. He was a man of outstanding beauty and infinite grace, Vasari said of him. He was striking and handsome, and his great presence brought comfort to the most troubled soul. Even discounting for the effusiveness of 16th-century biographers, it is clear that Leonardo was charming and attractive and had many friends. His disposition was so lovable that he commanded everyone's affection, according to Vasari. He was so pleasing in conversation that he attracted to himself the hearts of men. Paolo Giovio, a near contemporary who met Leonardo in Milan, similarly remembered his pleasant nature. He was friendly, precise and generous, with a radiant, graceful expression, Giovio wrote. His genius for invention was astounding, and he was the arbiter of all questions relating to beauty and elegance, especially in pageantry. All of this made him a man with many close friends. In the letters and writings of dozens of other prominent intellectuals in Milan and Florence, ranging from the mathematician Luca Pacioli to the architect Donato Bramante and the poet Piattino Piatti, there are references to Leonardo as a valued and beloved companion. Leonardo dressed colourfully, sometimes sporting, according to the Anonimo, a rose-coloured cloak which came only to his knees, though at the time long vestments were the custom. As he grew older, he grew a long beard, which came to the middle of his breast and was well-dressed and curled. Most notably, he was known for his willingness to share his blessings. He was so generous that he sheltered and fed all his friends, rich or poor, according to Vasari. He was not motivated by wealth or material possessions. In his notebooks he decried men who desire nothing but material riches and are absolutely devoid of the desire for wisdom, which is the sustenance and truly dependable wealth of the mind. As a result, he spent more time pursuing wisdom than working on jobs that would make him money beyond what he needed to support his growing household retinue. He possessed nothing and worked little, but he always kept servants and horses, Vasari wrote. The horses brought him much delight, Vasari wrote, as did all animals. Often when passing the places where birds were sold, he would take them with his own hand out of their cages, and having paid to those who sold them the price that was asked, he let them fly away into the air, restoring to them their lost liberty. Because of his love for animals, Leonardo was a vegetarian for much of his life, although his shopping lists show that he often bought meat for others in his household. He would not kill a flea for any reason whatsoever, a friend wrote. He preferred to dress in linen so as not to wear something dead. A Florentine traveller to India recorded that the people there do not feed on anything that has blood, nor will they allow anyone to hurt any living thing, like our Leonardo da Vinci. In addition to his prophecy tales that include dire descriptions of the practice of slaying animals for food, Leonardo's notebooks contain other literary passages assailing meat-eating. If you are, as you have described yourself, the king of the animals, he wrote of humans, why do you help other animals only so that they may be able to give you their young in order to gratify your palate? He referred to a vegetable diet as simple food and urged its adoption. Does not nature bring forth enough simple food things to satisfy your hunger? Or if you cannot content yourself with simple things, can you not do so by blending these simple foods together to make an infinite number of compounds? His rationale for avoiding meat derived from a morality based on science. Unlike plants, animals could feel pain, Leonardo realized. His studies led him to believe that this was because animals had the ability to move their bodies. Nature has given sensibility to pain to living organisms that have the power of movement in order to preserve those parts which might be destroyed by movement, he surmised. Pain is not necessary in plants. Salai. Among the young men who became Leonardo's companions, by far the most important was the scamp known as Salai, who arrived on July 22, 1490, when Leonardo was 38. Giacomo came to live with me, is the way he recorded the event in his notebook. It is an oddly elusive formulation, in contrast to saying that the young man had become his student or assistant. Then again, it was an oddly elusive relationship. Gian Giacomo Caprotti was then 10 years old, the son of an impoverished peasant from the nearby village of Oreno. Leonardo would soon be referring to him, for good reason, as Salai, or Little Devil. Soft and languid, with angelic curls and a devilish little smile, he would feature in dozens of Leonardo's drawings and notebook sketches, and for most of the rest of Leonardo's life, Salai would be his companion. He was the one, as noted earlier, described by Vasari as a graceful and beautiful youth with fine curly hair, in which Leonardo greatly delighted. It was not unusual for a servant boy to go to work at age 10, but Salai was something more. Leonardo would later occasionally refer to him as my pupil, but that was misleading. He never was more than a mediocre artist and produced few original paintings. Instead, he was Leonardo's assistant, companion, and amanuensis. And probably at some point, he became a lover. In one of Leonardo's notebooks, another of the students in the studio, perhaps a rival, drew a coarse caricature showing a large penis with two legs poking toward an object on which Salai is scribbled. In an unpublished Book of Dreams, written in 1560, Lomazzo, who knew one of Leonardo's students, imagined a dialogue between the ancient Greek sculptor Phidias and Leonardo, who confesses to loving Salai. Phidias asks bluntly whether they had engaged in sex. Did you perhaps play with him that backside game that Florentines love so much? Many times, Leonardo merrily responds. You should know that he was a most beautiful young man, especially at about 15. Which is perhaps an indication of when their relationship may have become physical. Are you not ashamed to say this? Asks Phidias. Leonardo, or at least Lomazzo's fictionalized version, is not. Why ashamed? Among men of worth there is scarcely greater cause for pride. Understand that masculine love is solely the product of merit, virtù, which joins together men of diverse feelings of friendship so that they may, from a tender age, arrive at manhood as stronger friends. As soon as he moved in with Leonardo, Salai began earning his nickname. The second day I had two shirts cut out for him, a pair of hose and a leather jacket, and when I put aside some money to pay for these things, he stole the money, Leonardo recorded. I could never make him confess, although I was quite certain of it. Nevertheless, he began taking Salai to dinner parties as his companion, which indicates that he was more than a sticky-fingered assistant or student. 2 days after he arrived, Leonardo took him to a dinner at the home of the architect Giacomo Andrea da Ferrara, where he proved unmannerly. Salai supped for two and did mischief for four, for he broke three cruets and spilled the wine, Leonardo wrote in his notebook. Leonardo, who rarely revealed much of a personal nature in his notebooks, mentioned Salai dozens of times, often in tones of exasperation that also betrayed amusement and affection. This included at least 5 times when he stole things. On the 7th day of September, he stole a stylus worth 22 soldi from Marco, who was staying with me. It was of silver, and he took it from his studio, and when Marco had searched for it a long time, he found it hidden in the box of Giacomo. During the wedding pageant for Ludovico Sforza and Beatrice d'Este in 1491, Leonardo noted, "When I was in the house of Messer Galeazzo de San Severino to arrange the festival for his tournament, and certain footmen had undressed to try on some of the costumes of the savages which were to appear at the festival, Giacomo went to the wallet of one of them as it lay on the bed with other clothes and took out whatever money he found there." As the tales pile up, one can be amused not only by Salai but also by Leonardo for continuing to tolerate and record his transgressions. "Maestro Agostino of Pavia gave me a Turkish hide in order to make a pair of boots, and Giacomo stole it from me within a month and sold it to a cobbler for 20 soldi, and with this money, by his own confession, he bought aniseed candy," reads yet another example. The lines of accounting are written in a small, impassive hand, but next to one entry, Leonardo's words in the margin are twice as big and scrawled in annoyance. "Thief, liar, obstinate, greedy." Their bickering would persist over the years. A shopping list that Leonardo dictated to an assistant in 1508 dissolves into, "Salai, I want peace, not war. No more wars, I give in." Leonardo nevertheless continued throughout his life to indulge Salai and dress him in colourful and dandy clothes, many of them pink, the costs of which, including at least 24 pairs of fancy shoes and a pair of stockings so expensive they must have been jewelled, would routinely be recorded in his notebooks. Drawings of old and young men. Even before Salai moved in with him, Leonardo began what would be a lifelong pattern of juxtaposing sketches of an androgynous, curly-haired pretty boy facing a craggy older man like the one on the theme sheet, with a jutting chin and aquiline nose, seen in Figure 24 in the PDF. As he later instructed, in narrative paintings you should closely intermingle direct opposites, because they offer a great contrast to each other, especially when they are adjacent. Thus, have the ugly one next to the beautiful, the large next to the small, the old next to the young. The pairing was a motif that he picked up from his mentor Verrocchio, who specialized in virile old warriors and pretty boys, and facing off the two types became a regular feature in his sketchbooks. Kenneth Clark described the combination. Most typical of such creations is the bald, clean-shaven man with formidable frown, nutcracker nose and chin, who appears sometimes in the form of a caricature, more often as an ideal. His strongly accentuated features seem to have typified for Leonardo vigor and resolution, and so he becomes the counterpart of that other profile which came with equal facility from Leonardo's pen, the epicene youth. These are, in fact, the two hieroglyphs of Leonardo's unconscious mind, the two images his hand created when his attention was wandering, virile and effeminate. They symbolize the two sides of Leonardo's nature. Leonardo's earliest known pair of such profiles appears on a notebook page from 1478 when he was still in Florence. See Figure 29. The old man has a long pointed nose curving down, a sunken upper lip, and an exaggerated jutting chin curving up, forming the nutcracker facial type Leonardo often used. The head of wavy hair hints that Leonardo may be drawing a caricature of his older self. Facing him, rendered in a few simple strokes, is a rather featureless, slender boy who gazes up languidly with a subtle twisting of his neck and bending of his body. The lithe and boyish figure, reminiscent of Verrocchio's statue of David that Leonardo likely modeled for, hints that Leonardo may have, consciously or not, been drawing a reflection of his younger self, juxtaposing his boyish and manly sides. There was also a hint of companionship in these face-offs. It is on this page from 1478 that Leonardo inscribed the words, "Fioravante di Domenico of Florence is my most beloved friend, as though he were my..." After Salai moved into his household in 1490, Leonardo's doodles and drawings began to feature a boy who is softer, fleshier, and a bit more sultry. This character, who we can safely assume is Salai, slowly matures over the years. A good example is a version of the craggy, jut-jawed man facing a young boy that Leonardo drew in the 1490s, see Figure 30. Unlike in his 1478 version, this time the young boy has bountiful curls pouring like a deluge from his head and cascading down his long neck. The eyes are big, but more vacant. The chin is fleshy. The full lips are shaped into what may be, on second glance, a Mona Lisa smile, though a bit more mischievous. He looks angelic yet also devilish. The older man's arm reaches to the boy's shoulder, but the forearm and the torsos are left partly blank, as if the two bodies are melding. Though not a self-portrait of Leonardo, who was then only in his mid-40s, the older man seems to be a caricature he uses over the years that conveys his own emotions as he faces the prospect of aging. Throughout his career, Leonardo would repeatedly and lovingly draw Salai. We see him age slowly while remaining at each stage soft and sensuous. When Salai is in his early 20s, Leonardo draws him with red chalk and pen standing in the nude. See Figure 31. His lips and chin are still boyish, his hair exuberantly curled, but his body and slightly spread arms have the musculature that we will see in Vitruvian Man and some of the anatomical drawings. Another full-length nude drawing, this one from behind, also shows him with arms and legs spread, his body strong, with just a hint of fleshiness. See Figure 32. A few years later, around 1510, Leonardo made another chalk drawing of Salai's head in profile, this time facing to our right. See Figure 33. It has all of the same features, from the swan-like neck to the fleshy chin and languid eyes. But he is now portrayed as just a touch older, though remembered as still boyish. His top lip is full and thrusting, his lower one soft and receding, forming yet again that hint of a devilish smile. Even in the last years of his life, Leonardo still seemed to be mesmerized by the Salai image. In one drawing from about 1517, he created a tender sketch of a remembered youthful Salai in profile, figure 34. His heavy-lidded eyes are still sultry and slightly vacant, his hair is still tightly curled in the way, as Vasari reported, in which Leonardo greatly delighted. Leonardo's many drawings of an old and a young man juxtaposed in profile are evoked in a telling way in a haunting, allegorical drawing that he made of figures representing pleasure and pain, figure 35. The young character depicting pleasure has some of Salai's looks. He is standing back to back and intertwined with the older man, who is the depiction of pain. Their bodies merge as their arms entangle. Pleasure and pain are represented as twins, Leonardo wrote on the drawing, because there never is one without the other. As usual with Leonardo's allegorical drawings, there are symbols and puns. Pain stands on mud, while pleasure stands on gold. Pain is dropping little spiked balls known as tribolo, a play on the word tribolazione for tribulation. Pleasure drops coins and holds a reed. Leonardo explained why the reed evokes the evil pleasures that are the source of pain. Pleasure is here represented with a reed in his right hand, which is useless and without strength, and the wounds it inflicts are poisoned. In Tuscany, they are used to support beds, to signify that it is here that vain dreams come. His notion of vain dreams appears to include sexual fantasies, and he went on to lament that they can distract a person from getting on with his work. It is here that much precious time is wasted and many vain pleasures are enjoyed, he wrote of a bed, both by the mind in imagining impossible things and by the body in partaking of those pleasures that are often the cause of the failing of life. Did this mean that Leonardo believed that some of the vain pleasures he indulged or imagined while in bed were a cause of his own failings? As he warned in his description of the phallic and useless reed that pleasure holds, if you take pleasure, know that he has behind him one who will deal you tribulation and repentance. Chapter 8. Vitruvian Man. A Tiburio for Milan's Cathedral. When Milan's authorities in 1487 were seeking ideas for building a lantern tower, known as a Tiburio, atop their cathedral, Leonardo seized the opportunity to establish his credentials as an architect. That year he had completed his plans for an ideal city, but they had engendered little interest. The competition to design the Tiburio was a chance to show that he could do something more practical. Milan's cathedral, figure 36 in the PDF, was a century old, but it still did not have the traditional Tiburio on the roof at the crossing of the nave and transept. The challenge, which had defeated a few previous architects, was to conform with the building's Gothic style and overcome the structural weakness of its crossing area. At least 9 architects entered the 1487 competition, approaching the task in a somewhat collaborative fashion, sharing ideas. The Italian Renaissance was producing artist-engineer-architects who straddled disciplines in the tradition of Brunelleschi and Alberti, and the Tiburio project gave Leonardo the opportunity to work with 2 of the best, Donato Bramante and Francesco Di Giorgio. They became his close friends, and their collaboration produced some interesting church designs. Far more important, it also led to a set of drawings based on the writings of an ancient Roman architect that sought to harmonize the proportions of a human to that of a church, an effort that would culminate with an iconic drawing by Leonardo that came to symbolize the harmonious relationship between man and the universe. Bramante served as the initial expert judging the Tiburio submissions. 8 years older than Leonardo, he was a farmer's son from near Urbino, with grand ambitions and appetites. He moved to Milan in the early 1470s to make a name for himself, and he carved out roles that ranged from entertainer to engineer. Like Leonardo, he began his work at the Sforza court by being an impresario of pageants and performances. He also wrote witty verses, offered up clever riddles, and occasionally accompanied his performances by playing a lyre or lute. Some of Leonardo's allegorical tales and prophecies were complements to Bramante's, and by the late 1480s they were working together on fantasias performed for special occasions and other effusions of the Sforza entertainment industry. Both men displayed dazzling brilliance and effortless charm, despite which they became close friends. In his notebooks, Leonardo affectionately called the architect Donino, and Bramante dedicated a book of poems about Roman antiquities to Leonardo, calling him a cordial, dear, and delightful associate. A few years after he and Leonardo became friends, Bramante painted a fresco that featured two ancient philosophers, Heraclitus and Democritus. See figure 37. Democritus, known to be amused by the human condition, is laughing, while Heraclitus is crying. Round-faced and balding, the former appears to be a self-portrait of Bramante, while the portrait of Heraclitus seems to be based on Leonardo. He has a profusion of flowing, tightly curled hair, rose-colored tunic, prominent eyebrows and chin, and a manuscript book in front of him with the characters in right-to-left mirror script. Thus we can imagine how Leonardo, still clean-shaven, looked in his prime. Bramante moved on from the role of impresario to being on retainer as an artist, engineer, architect of the Sforza court, thus shaping the role and paving the way for Leonardo. In the mid-1480s, when he and Leonardo were working together, Bramante displayed his combination of art and architecture talents by designing a fake apse, or choir area, behind the altar of Milan's Church of Santa Maria presso San Satiro. Because space was cramped, there was no room for a full apse. Using the knowledge of perspective that was spreading among Renaissance painters, Bramante conjured up a trompe-l'oeil, a painted optical illusion that made it seem as if the space had more depth. Within a few years, he and Leonardo would together work on a similar feat of engineering and perspective when Ludovico Sforza commissioned Bramante to rework the convent of Santa Maria delle Grazie by adding a new dining hall, and Leonardo was hired to paint on its wall a depiction of the Last Supper. Both Bramante and Leonardo favoured church designs that were based on strict symmetry. This led them to prefer central, temple-like plans that featured overlapping squares, circles, and other regular geometric shapes, as can be seen in many of Leonardo's church sketches. See figure 38. Bramante presented his written opinion on the Tiburio design ideas in September 1487. One issue was whether the tower should have four sides, which would fit more securely on the support beams of the roof, or eight sides. I maintain that the square is far stronger and better than the octagon, because it matches the rest of the building far better, he concluded. Leonardo received 6 payments in July through September 1487 for his work on the project, which probably included consulting with Bramante as he wrote his opinion. In one of his presentations, Leonardo made a philosophical pitch that drew on the analogy, of which he was so fond, between human bodies and buildings. Medicines, when properly used, restore health to invalids, and a doctor will make the right use of them if he understands the nature of man, he wrote. This too is what the sick cathedral needs. It needs a doctor architect who understands the nature of the building and the laws on which correct construction is based. He filled pages of his notebooks with drawings and descriptions of what caused structural weaknesses in buildings, and he was the first to do a systematic study on the origins of fissures in walls. The cracks that are vertical are caused by the joining of new walls with old ones, he wrote, for the indentations cannot bear the great weight of the wall added onto them, so it is inevitable that they should break. To shore up the unsteady parts of the Milan Cathedral, Leonardo devised a system of buttresses to stabilize the area around his proposed tower and, always a believer in experiment, designed a simple test to show how they would work. An experiment to show that a weight placed on an arch does not discharge itself entirely on its columns. On the contrary, the greater the weight placed on the arches, the less the arch transmits the weight to the columns. Let a man be placed on a weighing device in the middle of a well shaft, then have him push out his hands and feet against the walls of the well. You will find that he weighs much less on the scales. If you put weights on his shoulders, you will see for yourselves that the more weight you put on him, the greater will be the force with which he spreads his arms and legs and presses against the wall, and the less will be his weight on the scales. With the help of a carpenter's assistant he hired, Leonardo made a wooden model of his design for the Tiburio, for which he received a series of payments early in 1488. He did not try to have his Tiburio blend in with the cathedral's Gothic design and ornate exterior. Instead, he displayed his inbred fondness for Florence's Duomo. His many sketches for a Tuscan-style cupola seem more inspired by Brunelleschi's dome than the Gothic flying buttresses of Milan's cathedral. His most ingenious proposal was to create a double-shelled dome, like Brunelleschi's. It would be four-sided on the outside, as Bramante had recommended, but on the inside, it would be octagonal. Francesco di Giorgio is called in. After receiving Bramante's opinion, along with proposals from Leonardo and other architects, the Milanese authorities seemed baffled about what to do. So in April 1490, they convened a meeting of all who had been involved. The result was to call in yet another expert, Francesco di Giorgio from Siena. 13 years older than Leonardo, he was another exemplar of an artisan who combined art, engineering, and architecture. He had begun as a painter, moved as a young man to Urbino to work as an architect, returned to Siena to run the underground aqueduct system, and was a sculptor in his spare time. He was also interested in military weaponry and fortifications. In other words, he was the Leonardo of Siena. Like Leonardo, Francesco kept pocket-sized notebooks of design ideas, and in 1475 he began collecting them for a treatise on architecture intended as a successor to the one by Alberti. Written in unpolished Italian rather than Latin, Francesco's was designed as a manual for builders rather than a scholarly work. He tried to ground design in math as well as in art. The range of his ideas was similar to those in Leonardo's notebooks. Spilling across its pages were drawings and discussions of machinery, temple-like churches, weapons, pumps, hoists, urban designs, and fortified castles. In church design, he shared with Leonardo and Bramante a preference for a symmetrical Greek cross interior, in which the central plan has the same length for the nave and transept. An official cultural diplomacy request was sent from Milan's ducal court to the Council of Siena, describing the importance of the Tiburio project and asking that Francesco be permitted to come work on it. The response was reluctant acquiescence. The Siena councillors insisted that his work in Milan be done quickly, because he had many incomplete projects in Siena. By early June, Francesco was in Milan working on a new model for the Tiburio. A grand meeting was held later that month in the presence of Ludovico Sforza and the deputies of the cathedral. After inspecting three alternatives, they accepted Francesco's recommendations and chose two local architect-engineers who had been part of the competition. The result was an ornate, octagonal Gothic tower. See figure 36. It was very different from Leonardo's more graceful and Florentine approach, and he withdrew from the process. Leonardo nevertheless remained interested in church design, and he made more than 70 other drawings of beautiful domes and idealized plans for church interiors at the same time that he was studying the transformations of shapes and ways to square a circle. His most interesting church designs featured floor plans that embedded circles inside squares to form a variety of shapes, with the altar in the center, which were intended to evoke a harmonious relationship between man and the world. A trip with Francesco to Pavia. While they were working together on the Milan Cathedral's Tiburio project in June 1490, Leonardo and Francesco di Giorgio took a trip to the town of Pavia, 25 miles away, where a new cathedral was being built. See figure 39. The authorities in Pavia, knowing of the work that Leonardo and Francesco were doing in Milan, had asked Ludovico Sforza to send them as consultants. Ludovico wrote to his secretary, "The building supervisors of this city's cathedral have requested that we agree to provide them with that Sienese engineer employed by the building supervisors of the cathedral in Milan." He was referring to Francesco, whose name he apparently could not remember. In a postscript, he added that Master Leonardo of Florence should also be sent. Ludovico's secretary replied that Francesco could leave Milan in 8 days after his preliminary report on the Tiburio was in hand. "Master Leonardo the Florentine," he added, "is always ready whenever he is asked." Apparently Leonardo was eager to travel with Francesco. "If you send the Sienese engineer, he will come too," the secretary reported. The expense accounts of the Pavia authorities list a hotel payment on June 21st, paid to Giovanni Agostino Berneri, host of Il Saracino in Pavia, for expenses he incurred because of Masters Francesco of Siena and Leonardo of Florence, the engineers with their colleagues, attendants and horses, both of whom were summoned for a consultation about the building. Their friend and collaborator in Milan, Donato Bramante, had given advice a few years earlier on the design for Pavia's proposed cathedral. In contrast to Milan's cathedral, the resulting plan was decidedly non-Gothic, which made it more to Leonardo's taste. It had a simple facade and a very symmetrical interior design based on the Greek cross layout, with both the nave and the transept having the same length. That produced a balanced and equally proportioned geometrical elegance. Like the churches that Bramante designed, most notably St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, as well as the ones that Leonardo sketched in his notebooks, the plan featured circles and squares forming very harmonious and balanced areas. Francesco was at that time revising the manuscript of his treatise on architecture, and he discussed it with Leonardo as they travelled together. Leonardo would eventually acquire a lavishly illustrated copy. They also discussed another, more venerable book. In the 1,000-volume Visconti Library in the castle of Pavia, there was a beautiful manuscript copy of an architectural treatise by Vitruvius, a Roman military officer and engineer from the 1st century BC. For years, Francesco had been struggling to compile a translation of Vitruvius from Latin into Italian. There were many variations in the manuscript copies made of Vitruvius over the centuries, and he wanted to study the 14th century copy that existed in Pavia. So did Leonardo. Vitruvius. Marcus Vitruvius Pollio, born around 80 BC, served in the Roman army under Caesar and specialized in the design and construction of artillery machines. His duties took him to what are now Spain and France and as far away as North Africa. Vitruvius later became an architect and worked on a temple, no longer in existence, in the town of Fano, in Italy. His most important work was literary, the only surviving book on architecture from classical antiquity, De Architectura, known today as The 10 Books on Architecture. For many dark centuries, Vitruvius's work had been forgotten, but in the early 1400s, it was one of the many pieces of classical writing, including Lucretius's epic poem On the Nature of Things and Cicero's Orations, that were rediscovered and collected by the pioneering Italian humanist Poggio Bracciolini. At a monastery in Switzerland, Poggio found an 8th-century copy of Vitruvius's opus, and he sent it back to Florence. There, it became part of the firmament of rediscovered classical works that birthed the Renaissance. Brunelleschi used it as a reference when he travelled to Rome as a young man to measure and study the ruins of classical buildings, and Alberti quoted it extensively in his treatise on architecture. A Latin edition was published in the late 1480s by one of Italy's new print shops, and Leonardo wrote in a notebook, "Inquire at the stationers about Vitruvius." What made Vitruvius's work appealing to Leonardo and Francesco was that it gave concrete expression to an analogy that went back to Plato and the ancients, one that had become a defining metaphor of Renaissance humanism, the relationship between the microcosm of man and the macrocosm of the earth. This analogy was a foundation for the treatise that Francesco was composing. All the arts and all the world's rules are derived from a well-composed and proportioned human body, he wrote in the foreword to his fifth chapter. Man, called a little world, contains in himself all the general perfections of the whole world. Leonardo likewise embraced the analogy in both his art and his science. He famously wrote around this time, "The ancients called man a lesser world, and certainly the use of this name is well bestowed because his body is an analogue for the world." Applying this analogy to the design of temples, Vitruvius decreed that the layout should reflect the proportions of a human body, as if the body were laid out flat on its back upon the geometric forms of the floor plan. "The design of a temple depends on symmetry," he wrote at the outset of his third book. "There must be a precise relation between its components, as in the case of those of a well-shaped man." Vitruvius described in great detail the proportions of this well-shaped man that should inform the design of a temple. "The distance from his chin to the top of his forehead should be 1/10 of his whole height," he began, and proceeded with many other such notations. "The length of the foot is 1/6 of the height of the body, of the forearm 1/4, and the breadth of the breast is also 1/4. The other members too have their own symmetrical proportions, and it was by employing them that the famous painters and sculptors of antiquity attained to great and endless renown." Vitruvius's descriptions of human proportions would inspire Leonardo, as part of the anatomy studies he had just begun in 1489, to compile a similar set of measurements. More broadly, Vitruvius's belief that the proportions of man are analogous to those of a well-conceived temple and to the macrocosm of the world became central to Leonardo's worldview. After detailing human proportions, Vitruvius went on to describe in a memorable visualization a way to put a man in a circle and square in order to determine the ideal proportion of a church. "In a temple there ought to be harmony in the symmetrical relations of the different parts to the whole. In the human body the central point is the navel. If a man is placed flat on his back, with his hands and feet extended, and a compass centered at his navel, his fingers and toes will touch the circumference of a circle thereby described. And just as the human body yields a circular outline, so too a square may be found from it. For if we measure the distance from the soles of the feet to the top of the head, and then apply that measure to the outstretched arms, the breadth will be found to be the same as the height, as in the case of a perfect square." It was a powerful image. But as far as we know, no one of note had made a serious and precise drawing along these lines in the 15 centuries since Vitruvius composed his description. Then, around 1490, Leonardo and his friends proceeded to tackle this depiction of man spread eagle amid a church and the universe. Francesco produced at least three such drawings that were designed to accompany his treatise and translation of Vitruvius. One of them shows a sweet and dreamy image of a man in a circle and a square, see figure 40. It is a suggestive rather than precise drawing. The circle, square, and body do not attempt to show proportions and are instead rendered casually. Two other drawings that Francesco made depict a man more carefully proportioned inside a design of circles and squares in the shape of a church floor plan. See figures 41 and 42. None of his drawings is a memorable work of art, but they show that Francesco and Leonardo, at the time of their 1490 trip to Pavia, were both enchanted by the image Vitruvius had conceived. Dinner with Giacomo Andrea. Around the same time, another dear friend of Leonardo produced a drawing based on Vitruvius's passage. Giacomo Andrea was part of the collaborative circle of architects and engineers gathered by Ludovico at the court of Milan. Luca Pacioli, a mathematician at the court and another close friend of Leonardo, wrote a dedication to an edition of his book On Divine Proportion that listed the distinguished members of that court. After hailing Leonardo, Pacioli adds, "There was also Giacomo Andrea de Ferrara, as dear to Leonardo as a brother, a keen student of Vitruvius's works." We have met Giacomo Andrea before. He was the host of the dinner that Leonardo went to with Salai 2 days after the 10-year-old scamp had become his assistant, at which Salai supped for two and did mischief for four, including breaking 3 cruets and spilling the wine. That dinner happened on July 24th, 1490, just 4 weeks after Leonardo and Francesco returned from their trip to Pavia. It was one of those priceless historical dinners that makes you yearn for a time machine. The conversation, when not being distracted by Salai's antics, was evidently about the manuscript of Vitruvius that Leonardo and Francesco had just seen at the university. Andrea decided to try his own hand at illustrating Vitruvius's idea, and one can imagine him discussing it over dinner with Leonardo, hoping that Salai didn't spill wine on their sketches. Andrea produced a simple version of a spread-armed man in a circle and a square. See figure 43. Notably, the circle and square are not centered. The circle rises higher than the square, which allows the man's navel to be in the center of the circle and his genitals to be in the center of the square, like Vitruvius had suggested. The man's arms are stretched outward, Christ-like, and his feet are close together. Andrea would end up being killed and brutally quartered by French troops when they captured Milan 9 years later. Shortly thereafter, Leonardo would search for and find his manuscript copy of Vitruvius's work. Messer Vincenzo Aliprando, who lives near the Inn of the Bear, has Giacomo Andrea's Vitruvius, he declared in a notebook entry. In the 1980s, Andrea's drawing was rediscovered. Architectural historian Claudio Sgarbi found a heavily illustrated manuscript copy of Vitruvius's tome that was languishing in an archive in Ferrara, Italy. He determined that manuscript had been compiled by Andrea. Among its 127 illustrations was Andrea's version of Vitruvian Man. Leonardo's version. There are two key differences that distinguish Leonardo's version of Vitruvian Man from those done around the same time by his two friends, Francesco Di Giorgio and Giacomo Andrea. In both scientific precision and artistic distinction, Leonardo's is in an entirely different realm. See figure 44. Rarely on display, because prolonged exposure to light would cause it to fade, it is kept in a locked room on the fourth floor of the Galleria dell'Accademia in Venice. When a curator brought it out and placed it before me on a table, I was struck by the indentations made by the stylus of Leonardo's metal point pen and the 12 pricks made by the point of his compass. I had the eerie and intimate sensation of seeing the hand of the master at work more than 5 centuries earlier. Unlike those of his friends, Leonardo's drawing is meticulously done. His lines are not sketchy and tentative. Instead, he dug hard with his stylus, carving the lines confidently into the page as if he were making an etching. He had planned this drawing very carefully and knew precisely what he was doing. Before he began,